29. Classic House. Before Channel 4's insufferable Grand Designs programme, few people realised that it was possible or legal to build your own home, apart from me. My project was in the works a full 6 months before the first transmission of the show, and I defy anyone to prove otherwise. Unlike the deeply unpleasant couples who appear on Grand Designs, I wanted to create the perfect home rather than an art installation with a built-in toilet. So, working with a team of expensive architects, I asked them to duplicate exactly the design used by Red Row Homes, with a soupçon of Barrett thrown in around the porch area. Imagine Henry VIII had commissioned, nay, ordered, Red Row and Barrett to create a modern 21st century house for a pre-Renaissance fat king using the efficiencies of modern techniques, combined with a Tudor brick quality, a sort of Hampton Court fit for a Norfolk conservative. That's the effect I was going for. The finishing touch was to be a boot scraper outside the front door. When I see one of those outside a house, I think they know which way to vote at a general election. I could sense that the architects were disappointed not to be able to flex their creative mind muscles. But Red Row and Barrett are experts in creating homes. Architects aren't. Besides, as with advertising agencies, it's hard to think of architects as genuinely creative people when the best company names they can muster are a list of the owner's surnames. Breeden Allison Lyons, or Humpleton Goggins and Fox, or Tythe St. Crooks, or Cannock Jones Skilly Andrews Haynes, or Peterson Johnson Magnuson Hansen, or Dennis Dennison Dennis, or Grigson Smith Oliver, or Barrow McGuigan Bounder, or Hiscock Greengrass Mitchell and Matthews. I could go on, but I won't. If advertisers slash architects were even a fraction as clever as they think they are, Swinson Shaw Lancashire, that would be another example, they'd call themselves Rocksteady Architects, or Pizzazz Advertising. The fact that they don't proves they're either vain or thick. They could, should, have taken a leaf out of my book. Long before the design was finished, I'd brained out a list of potential names of the property. Coleman House, Atlantis, Ace House, Allen House, The Cottage, The Old Rectory, Barn Cottage, Follyfoot, Steed Manor, Lord House, Rockford House, Flambards, Brideshead House, The Skirmishers, Apache, Tomahawk, Scepter House, The Cinnamons, it's just a lovely ingredient, Classic House, The Classics, Manor House, Bentley House, Large Cottage. That kind of thing. No, I was happy for the architects to mimic the Red Row Boys wholesale. Then I paid them handsomely, and the building work began. But where to live in the meantime? The Linton Travel Tavern had made it abundantly clear that I was welcome back any time, but knowing that builders are often ex-offenders, I thought it best to stay on site where I could better observe slash befriend slash monitor them. I would be staying in a static caravan, see picture section, a 10-footer from the yet-to-be-better Delta Range. I was comfortable with this. I'd be living in it for 3 years anyway, parked up in the garden of a kindly farmer, one of the very, very few. It's funny, when you move from a hotel to a detached house in a 10-foot static home, people are quick to assume you're down on your luck financially. Nothing could be further from the truth. After all, for some time, Jimmy Savile lived in a caravan, absolutely insists it was a lifestyle choice. Scruffy crooner David Essex also lived in one. I may be wrong about this, but he looks like a gypsy. I'm not sure of his ethnicity, but I'm reliably informed he once tried to put a curse on Leo Sayer after the argument over a bill in an Indian restaurant. My reasons had nothing to do with money. Caravanning had long been an ambition of mine. It gave me the opportunity to live out the holiday I'd always been denied in my harrowing childhood, minus the swing ball. At the same time, I hoped it would give me a chink of insight into the mindset of the travelling community, so that I might come to understand how they even consider dumping a bin bag full of used nappies in the ginnel next to someone's house. No, I was doing pretty fine, thanks. I was approaching my 200th episode of Skirmish, and had learnt all there is to know about military strategy. I don't think it was in any way arrogant of me to offer my services as a consultant to the Ministry of Defence. I revoked the offer when I realised it might mean travelling to London or Aldershot, but I'm confident they'd have literally bitten my hand off. At the same time, my other business interests were blossoming, like the small flowers that grow on trees each spring. Pear Tree Productions had been a great success, having achieved everything it had set out to do. And so, with its mission accomplished, it was placed into liquidation. Instead, my efforts were focused on a new and exciting venture. The Apache Group of Companies was aimed squarely at the canny businessman, a one-stop shop providing everything a business might need, comprising six distinct brands: Apache Communications, Apache Productions, Apache Office Supplies, Apache Media Training, Apache Risk Management, Trust No One, and Apache Military Strategy. It was a welcome revenue stream that complemented Brand Partridge beautifully. It was a tri-headquartered concern, with my business activities based out of the static home, the property under construction, and Chorister's Country Club. Now a leading light in the local business community, I'd taken membership of Chorister's to provide a much-needed respite from the hustle, bustle, and fussle of Norfolk life. As a haven for businessmen, Chorister's was quite unique, with the Norwich Club only complemented by the one in Bristol, another in the Roman town of Chester, and one at Stansted Airport. Much like a Masonic lodge, it provided a meeting point where the region's most important people could get together, share ideas, and do each other clandestine favours. Unlike a Masonic lodge, there was no snobbishness towards celebrity broadcasters, nor was there any suggestion that members must sacrifice livestock and daub themselves in its blood while chanting. I liked it there very much and enjoyed offering suggestions to the management as to how the staff could improve. I'm still a member to this day. After several years of lobbying, I've managed to ban children entirely. There's now a heated outhouse for children with a light and running water. The Apache group of companies had its fair share of work. Some people think it didn't, but they're wrong because it did. Trust me, Apache Communications made quite the name for itself and found a niche satisfying the easy-to-satisfy corporate market, whose idea of entertainment is generally limited to a Dilbert cartoon or the use of Comic Sans font in an otherwise serious PowerPoint presentation. I did well out of it, my versatility and willingness to leave my principles at the door for the right price making me an attractive proposition for even the most toxic brands. The only time I faced a slight moral twinge was when asked to give a motivational presentation plus rock music to a well-known cigarette brand. Tobacco was a sensitive subject area because I knew my assistant's racist mother had just died of lung cancer. Upset an employee for money or upset a lucrative paymaster, you can see the bind I was in. Eventually, I agreed to do it. Even the most ardent do-gooder would agree that the £5,000 fee made my assistant's feelings pretty inconsequential. Sometimes in business, you have to be hard-headed. It turned out my assistant's mum died of colon cancer anyway, so I was absolved/vindicated. And the presentation? It went well, thanks. Ever the pro, I always made sure I gave the client exactly what they wanted. Fail to prepare? Prepare to fail, as I once had engraved on the underside of a watch that I've subsequently never worn. And so it was that later that week, I walked out in front of an audience of 400 tipsy sales execs wearing a gas mask. After the 15-second blast of intro music, Every Breath You Take, The Police with Sting, stopped, I began. I once had a teacher who smoked, I said. He smoked his whole life, didn't miss a day's work. He died at 36. Ha ha ha! I was paid in full. Like my now-completed house, I opted for the name Classic House. The Partridge that saw in the third millennium post-Christ was strong, impressive, and had fully working plumbing. Yes, this was a good time for me. A very good time. People noticed that this incarnation was good, and they liked it. That, the liking of other people towards myself, found itself manifested with all the clarity this sentence has in manifesting itself in front of yourself as you currently read. For one thing, I was promoted to Radio Norwich's glamour slot, Norfolk Nights. It really didn't get any better than that. According to listener figures, it was only the third most popular slot on the station, but that's statistics for you. You can make statistics say anything. Statistics say that 80% of women under the age of 30 are either indifferent to or actively dislike my current show, Mid-Morning Matters. That doesn't make it true. My show came directly before the graveyard slot of Dave Clifton. Despite our differences, I took no pleasure in having a much better slot than Dave. I mean, I enjoyed helping him out because, and he'd be the very, very first to admit this, he needed all the help he could get. Dave was drinking a hell of a lot by now, and no amount of polo mints can mask that. I'd like to say it wasn't affecting his broadcasting, but that would be fraud. Dave couldn't master anything like the energy needed to carry a 3-hour late-night show, so I'd have to generate enough energy and momentum in the final hours of Norfolk Nights to carry the listener to the bitter end, and it was bitter, of Dave's show. It's similar to the slingshot technique used to propel the Galileo probe out into the solar system. They basically razzed it round the sun a few times to get its speed up, and then they used that momentum to hurl it into deep space. That was what I did to my listeners in the final hour of my show before pelting them into the atmosphere-free void of Dave's slot. We've never spoken about it, but I was doing him a massive favour. Still, I was happy to do it every night of the week for Dave because he was and is in a very bad place. If I thought Dave minded me saying any of this, of course, I'd not have committed it to print. I wouldn't dream of upsetting the guy, because I know he has a bit of a temper, although it's mainly directed towards women. In terms of making me feel good, this gave me a metaphorical hand job, as did, less metaphorically, the new love in my life, Sonia, then 33. Yes, on top of a luxury abode, a successful business empire, a burgeoning television and radio career, and membership of Choristers, I also had a girlfriend who was significantly younger than me, 14 years younger. Sonia was responsible for awakening my dormant libido and making it do press-ups. It had been a slumber for a while, apart from a truly distasteful dalliance with a menopausal member of staff years earlier. I won't say too much about her. I've no doubt she'll be listening to this. She still sends me Christmas cards with glitter glued onto a picture of Our Lord, with a sort of ready-brick glow around him, and inside the inscription says, "For unto us this day a child is born," which is fair enough, but I've always found her continued correspondence a bit desperate. My sex life post-Carol had been as threadbare as the gusset of my number one dad novelty briefs. But Sonia changed all that, and how. I've heard of the phrase, a healthy sex life, but this was ridiculous. I don't know if it's possible to be too healthy, Lance Armstrong maybe, but that's what our sex life was. Within reason, I loved every minute of my time with Sonia. She was introduced to me by Pete Gabitas, MD of Blue Barn Media, sadly no longer with us. Pete had been a confidant and friend and a lender of production facilities for over a decade. Pete had a stunning Ukrainian girlfriend, a decade his junior, and arranged similar girlfriends for six or seven of us. Mine was probably the second best. Lithe, smooth-skinned, and so youthful, I'd started pubing before she was even born. I couldn't help but notice that she was a svelte, effortless size 8. In other words, she'd achieved, through genetics and poverty, the exact body shape that Carol had been so fruitlessly striving for since she was 20. Just a thought. And right from the off, it was an exciting time. I think I've mentioned what a lot of sex we had. Ever the joker, she bought a window sticker that said, "If the caravan's rocking, don't come knocking." And I made my own one that said, "If it looks like we're having sexual intercourse in here, please respect our privacy." I was in two minds about whether to include intimate details of my sex life in this book, but I read a pamphlet in a dentist's waiting room that said it was healthy and important to speak openly about sexual issues, so I will. If Carol is reading, that's her lookout. Sex with Carol was all very sedate. It was effective, at least two of our copulations resulted in children, but sedate. With Sonia, it was much more spontaneous, what I like to call smash-and-grab sex, or a ram raid. Sonia delighted in the spontaneity of our sexual salad days and relished my playfulness. Using the full area of the caravan, I like to pretend to be a KGB agent. But as a Ukrainian who'd spent half her life as part of the Eastern Bloc, she'd rather pretend to be an East German gypsy, so I'd be the Stasi. So I'd ask to see her papers, before mounting her from behind over the twin hobs that were concealed beneath a work surface. She'd pretend to be confused, and I think you get the idea, gents. At that point, we must draw down a veil. Suffice to say, it ended with us showering off, and me returning to my normal accent, Sonia had retained hers, before we'd both settled down to a boil-in-the-bag curry whilst watching a VHS of Taggarts and Magnums, the austere greyness of those Glaswegian skyscapes contrasting perfectly with the sunshine of Magnum PI, like a TV detective yin and yang. But it was more than sexual. Apart from the lots of sex we were having, Sonia had plenty more to offer. She had a wonderful anti-aging effect on me, like oil of ole has on middle-aged women's cracked, craggy skin. Energetic, boisterous, and really very zesty. She loved to laugh. Boy, how she loved to laugh. And had a relatively infectious giggle. I'm glad to say it was the only infectious thing about her. I'd had her fully checked out before anything happened. A lot of nonsense is spoken about germs being passed from one to another. There's nothing more unsexy than talking about venereal disease. When I'm with a new lover, I merely casually suggest / insist that we both take a hot bath together with 3 caps of Dettol. an activity that is sexy and hygienic. All in all, Sonia had that indiscriminate, fun-loving quality that you often find with people from post-Soviet regimes. It's as if their people have cast off the state-imposed grumpiness of communism and are now grabbing life with both hands. After a while, of course, it becomes incredibly tiresome. But Sonia's love of practical jokes, sex, laughter, chintzy homeware, and relentless intercourse was a sometimes source of periodic happiness for quite a while. We broke up just hours after the house was completed. She was understandably miffed by this, but as I explained patiently in rudimentary English, it was a new build, so I wanted shoes off at the door, and she was hopeless at remembering to do that. You know that phrase, if you love someone, set them free? I've always liked the sound of that, even if its logic is plainly horse shit. It's the equivalent of saying, if you like beef burgers, don't eat them, or if you hate London, go and live there. Instead, I've adapted it slightly to read, if you don't love someone and don't want to hang around with them anymore, set them free. It just makes more sense. Breaking the news to her wasn't easy. We'd been living together for a year and a half, for goodness sake, and she'd often talked about marriage, ideally to me, but had to push anyone with UK citizenship. This was a big deal for her. So I locked myself in the bathroomette and got my assistant to do it. She broke the news with some relish, a bit too much, if you ask me. Of course, Sonia was devastated. She kept banging on the door and telling me to come out and face her. Knowing she was from a former Soviet country where human rights atrocities are commonplace, I had no idea what she was capable of, so I had no choice but to stay inside. "Come out, Alan," she was shouting. Through the door, I could hear my assistant trying to placate slash fib to her. "He's not in there anymore," she attempted. "He's clambered out of the window and ran off." I winced at her utter inability to lie and pledged to fine her £10 later on. "Alan, I love you," she kept shouting. Sonia, not my assistant. Ugh. Poor kid, I thought as I did my belt up. I was in the toilet anyway, so I thought I might as well make use of it. But I became less sympathetic with each shout, because it was repetitive, and other than the theme tune to Ski Sunday, I don't like repetitive noises. She stayed for absolutely ages. I found this irritating because I'd promised to send a showreel to Bid Up TV, and the post office was going to shut. After a few hours, she calmed down and sloped off, but I'd missed the last post and never got the BU TV job. Shame, because it was one of my favourite channels. I used to practice the patter in the shower, imagining I was selling Radox or a bath mitt. So I moved into the house alone. A big space for one, certainly, but I liked that, sometimes running around the building with a makeshift cape around my collar. It had four good-sized bedrooms, and I used to alternate between rooms 1 and 4, leaving 2, Fernando's, and 3, Denise's, untouched in case they dropped by and needed to go to sleep. Still do. And Sonia? Well, she and I are still very close, in the sense that she's now my cleaner. I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.